It's time for conversations about our food and how it's grown on Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.
Growing up on a farm in central Illinois, I spent many hot, sweaty afternoons hand-hoeing the weeds and the corn stalks that were growing in the rows of soybeans. And years later, and still around 30 years ago, I remember coming home and hearing many locals at the coffee shop, townspeople and farmers alike, praising the miraculously weed-free soybean fields that surrounded the restaurant. At the same time, locals were not calling it GMO, but they knew what they saw, and they liked what they saw. Some of them were like me and didn't care for hot afternoons doing handwork in bean fields. Well, as we all know by now, over subsequent decades, GMO became controversial for many reasons, but in my mind, foremost above them was mistrust of a few big corporations that were accused of being greedy and suspected of having government regulators bamboozled. Well, there are many books and, more recently, movies proclaiming facts and myths and fears, suspicions, innuendos, contradictory research, and images that would frighten the children. And if you Google GMO, you'll get over 26 million items, with no doubt thousands that would support whatever theory you prefer to believe. Although respected scientific bodies have consistently concluded that GMO products were safe, grassroots campaigns surfaced across the country to just label it because, regardless of safety, they believed it should be up to a consumer to decide whether or not they want to consume foods produced with genetic engineering. The debates raged and were battled in several states, but it was the passage of a GMO labeling law in Vermont that got the attention of Congress when it was realized we were on our way to having different food label laws for different states. To preempt what was seen as imminent catastrophe, Congress passed a labeling law, and it was signed by President Obama. But in fact, it wasn't really a labeling law. It was a disclosure law. Food manufacturers had to make information available to consumers as to whether a food product contained ingredients that were genetically engineered. And on the food label, information, a symbol, a link, or a QR code would be required that would take consumers to the answers to all their questions about the product, including whether it was genetically engineered. After USDA conducts additional research on consumer ability to use technology like smartphones to retrieve the information, there will be more public comment before final rules and regulations go in effect in 2018. And in the meantime, some still want information on the label, and some companies are going to oblige, not waiting for the final regulations to go into effect. So if you're curious about all of this, or if you're one of those who says, I don't care if the major scientific bodies say GMO are safe, I want to know, today's conversation will be of interest. Our guest on Farm to Table Talk is Greg Jaffe, the Biotechnology Project Director at the Center for Science in the Public Interest. Greg, welcome to Farm to Table Talk.
Well, thank you very much, Roger.
So, Greg, again, you're right in the middle of this, but I think we need to start off with the fact that Center for Science for the Public Interest has had a point of view. And before we get into what that point of view is exactly, why don't you explain who are your constituents? Who does CSPI represent in these discussions?
So, Roger, the Center for Science for the Public Interest is a nonprofit consumer organization. We'll call them an NGO, non-governmental organization. We work on food and nutrition issues, and we've been around for, at this point, I think more than 47 years, started by Michael Jacobson, a PhD scientist, and two other PhD scientists who wanted to bring science into the advocacy and education arena on behalf of consumers. So our mandates of our organization is to advocate on behalf of consumers in the food and nutrition area, and also to educate consumers and stakeholders about food and nutrition issues. So we've been doing that for a long time. We publish a Nutrition Action Health newsletter, which comes out 10 times a year, which has, I think, over 600,000 subscribers, that provides information to consumers about about their food, about the relationship between their diet and the food they eat and the health and their health. And it's sort of a, you know, to provide scientific information as well as practical information about how to improve your diet. Our funding, we get most of our funding from our member subscribers, so those people who get our newsletter pay $10 or $20 a year for a subscription, and we ask those people for donations, and some give us $5 and some give us $1,000, and the vast majority of our operating budget comes from those member subscribers. We also take funding from philanthropic foundations that are independent. An example might be the Gates Foundation if they wanted to give us money, or the Rockefeller Foundation if they wanted to give us money. We don't take funding from industry, and we have not done that in our 47 years of existence. And we also don't take funding from the U.S. government. And we do that because we do advocate on behalf of consumers, and we do therefore advocate in front of the government, sometimes lobbying, as well as trying to convince industry to do the right thing. So we don't want our messages in any way to be compromised from our funding source.
So when you say you don't take money from the industry, so take, for example, these companies that have GMO products, for example. I assume they're part of it, or their trade association or boards or councils that are involved. That's part of industry, obviously.
Right. So we wouldn't take money from General Mills, but we also wouldn't take money from Microsoft, even if they weren't part of the food industry. We don't take money from any industry, not just members of the food industry.
So what
example,
point, I'm wondering,
we
Greg.
We take money from a trade association either that represented those same interests.
You know, Greg, I'm wondering, at what point did you say, okay, for the consumer's interest here, biotechnology is going to be important? Was there some point in, I don't know, years past that your policymakers, your leadership saw this issue coming and said, look, we got to go hire a Greg Jaffe. We need to have somebody working on biotech. I'm just curious at that spot in recognition that this was an issue that had to be addressed in the interest of consumers.
So we are the Center for Science in the Public Interest with the emphasis on science. So we very much pride ourselves on the fact that we try to make science-based advocacy and science-based decision-making. So we, you know, try to look at the best science that's out there and then advocate based on that and educate based on that best science. And the biotechnology project started way back in 2001 when I was hired. And it actually came out of the fact that our executive director, Michael Jacobson, at the time had been asked to testify in Congress, not in Congress, at FDA, about what they should be doing in terms of their oversight of genetically engineered crops. And in looking at that information and trying to prepare for that testimony, he sort of realized that these foods were now entering our food supply, and there was a need for a moderate consumer perspective that would look at the science out there, tell it like it is, both on the benefits and the risks, and advocate for appropriate regulation of the technology, because there are applications out there that are producing benefits and will be producing benefits in the future. Some of those benefits may arise to consumers, or some may arise to farmers, some may arise to the environment, but acknowledge that there were many safe applications of this technology that could have benefits, and that we should, in our project, work to ensure proper oversight and education around those products.
You know, my impression is that your engagement came to the conclusions, it seemed fairly early, now stop me if I'm wrong on this, but it seemed fairly early you were coming to the conclusion that genetic engineering could be a good thing, it's not necessarily a bad thing, but there had to be adequate research and adequate regulations. And now, was I being a little hasty in coming to that conclusion of my read of generally where you fit?
So I think, you know, our view is we're not against technology or for technology. We look at each technology and its applications. And, you know, the questions we ask are those applications safe and are those beneficial in some means for some reason? And I want to just clarify that I think for genetic engineering, it's not about the technology itself, the process, but about the products that are provided, that are developed through that process, and you have to look at each one of those on a case-by-case basis. So we looked at the current products that are being grown in the United States and looked at the evidence around their safety, and came to the same conclusion that the government and others had come out with, which was that the current crops that are being grown in the United States that have been genetically engineered are safe to eat, foods made from those crops, and safe to grow them. That doesn't mean there aren't any impacts. It just means that they're safe, that one can do that, and that there are some benefits. And again, the benefits are on a case-by-case basis. So that's sort of how we came to where we're at today.
And then the application of genetic engineering, when you're tracking what's going on, what's your feeling about how consumers have, or some consumers, have gotten so worried and mistrustful and suspicious that they may in fact not be safe, which again led up to what we're going to talk about on labeling. Did you see that developing? Did you get feedback in your own organization that no matter what you'd say, there are just some people that say, I just don't trust them?
So, again, I'm not going to put myself in any individual consumer's mind. Everybody has, there are a lot of intelligent consumers out there, and they come to their own conclusions from looking at information out there. I would say that we are in a information world today with the internet, and there's lots of information on the internet, and some of that information is good and some of that information isn't very good. I'm a father and I have three kids, and one of my goals has been to try to help my kids figure out what is good information versus what is bad information, and it's not so obvious all the time. So I think there's a lot of information out there about genetically engineered crops. I think that there are a lot of emotions around them, not just about the safety of them, but some of them were developed by big multinational companies that are U.S.-based, and they were part of industrial agriculture, and there are some people who don't support those companies that produce those or the kind of agriculture that they're being used in the United States, and that may or may not be independent of whether they're actually safe or not.
And so there are products out there. I mean, certainly corn, soybeans, there's not that many, but there's not as many products or commodities as I think sometimes people are led to believe, kind of a handful out of 350 crops, but that goes into thousands and thousands of products, and that could be, your cookies and crackers and all sorts of things might include some products that were genetically engineered. And that leads to the issue of the Congress passing the law, and in a part reaction to, I mean, large part reaction to Vermont passing a law on GMO labeling. Could you summarize what the congressional action, what did it do? What's the law now that Congress passed about that refers to GMO labeling or refers to labeling?
So let me just give you a little background on that. I don't mean to critique your opening statement.
Sure.
So the background to the genetically engineered food disclosure law is that you are correct. Vermont passed a law that was going to require that foods and ingredients that came from genetically engineered crops would need to be labeled. And that law was to go into effect on July 1st, 2016. There were also two other states that had passed laws. One was Connecticut and one was Maine. Those laws, however, had clauses in them that said they would not come into effect until some of the neighboring states had also passed similar laws, such that there was a big enough number of people covered by those laws. So the concept being that Connecticut didn't want to go it alone. They wanted to wait till Massachusetts and New York, some bigger states, where there was a bigger part of the market kind of thing. So there were other laws that were passed, but those were not, they weren't in effect, and they may never have ever gotten into effect. It's sort of an interesting way to write a law. And then there were also, just so you know, there were four ballot initiatives. There was a ballot initiative in California, a ballot initiative in Oregon, Washington, and Colorado, all ballot initiatives to try to require mandatory labeling of foods and ingredients that came from genetically engineered crops. And none of those passed. Some of them were very close margins, such as in Oregon, but some of them were also very large margins, such as in Colorado. So, and then there were a number of other states that also had introduced by a member of their legislature a law requiring mandatory labeling. So that's the background for Congress's involvement. And so there was a lot of people who were concerned that that we were going down a pathway where either Vermont would dictate what the national standard was, because a lot of food companies don't label solely for Vermont.
Sure.
And they don't produce products just for Vermont. They go around to lots of different. Their products are distributed to many different states. So they did not want to have the Vermont setting the standard for the national, for the nation, nor did they want other states having different standards, and the ability to be able to label for all of those was going to be impossible. So there was a big push to have a national system. The House and Senate had bills introduced. There was lots of discussion around those, lots of negotiation. And what came out of it was a bill that was passed by both houses of Congress and signed on July 2016, by President Obama. And the law doesn't actually have a name, but what USDA has been calling it is the U.S. Bioengineered Food Disclosure Law.
But I'm sorry, I'm going to have to go back and clip in a little bit here of this, but the bioengineered disclosure law, it's going to require people to put information, but then they're still trying to determine whether or not they simply put some label on the cover or some link to a site. Is that where the process is currently? To a link to a site that says, here's all the story about this food.
So let me also just give us some background. So,
sure.
The law is called the disclosure law. It is mm-hmm. not a labeling law.
Okay.
So there, and I make that distinction because the law makes that, is not, it's, so a lot of people call this a GMO labeling law.
Right.
I think a lot of people, when they think of labeling, think of something on the package.
Yes.
The information that's contained on the package, that's part of the label. But this law specifically set up a national mandatory system for disclosing the presence of bioengineered material in food.
Mm-hmm.
So foods or ingredients that came from genetic engineered crops. So it sets up a mandatory disclosure system, but it does not necessarily have to be on the label. And in fact, the law says that the U.S. Department of Agriculture, who has been tasked with implementing this law, will issue regulations within 2 years of the signing of the law. That would be the end of July 2018. And the law specifically says that the food manufacturer can choose to disclose by one of the following means. So there could be text on the label, and that text would be, what text could be allowed will be decided in the regulations by USDA. It could be a symbol on the package, and USDA could decide on the kind of symbol that might be allowed, or it can be an electronic or digital link on the package, such as a QR code, a barcode, or a smart label that would take a consumer to a website that would provide information. And again, USDA would define how that was done and what information might be required in that electronic link. Small manufacturers, which haven't been defined yet in the regulations, would have a fourth option, which would be to put a phone number on their product, and consumers could an 800 phone number on the package, and consumers could call to get more information. So it's called a disclosure because the information will be available to the consumer, and it will be mandatory that the information be made available to the consumer. But it's not called labeling, and the distinction that the law makes is because it won't necessarily be on the package.
I'm really glad you're reminding me of this. I mean, it sounds like I'm getting a little rusty on the terminology, but this issue has been around so long it's hard to recall. And obviously you're in the middle of it, and I really appreciate the fact that you can draw this into a better picture. And using the term disclosure, that's quite a bit different than just labeling. You can get everything. You can get all the information. In fact, that seems to be what some of the conversation is about, like smart labeling, for example, is that you go in there and there's lots and lots of information, nutritional information and other things other than just genetic engineering that's can be in this disclosure process. Isn't that right?
Yes, I mean, I'm not an expert on smart labels, so person to talk to, but the concept is that, you know, you can provide lots of different information to the consumer, lots of information the consumer may want to know about a food, how to produce a food, how the food was produced, how to eat the food, you know, how to prepare it. A host of different information can be provided to the consumer through a QR code or a barcode or a smart label type situation. So I'm not an expert on that, but that is the concept around that. And you also can provide a lot more information than just a couple of words. So for something like genetically engineered foods, you could talk about which crop in particular was engineered. You might talk about what the benefit was to the farmer or the environment from that. You could provide additional information other than just a very short statement about whether it was genetically engineered or not.
Now, Greg, something that you've weighed in on recently was that these labels or the information about the product, it wouldn't necessarily mean that the whole product be identified as genetically engineered if there are some components of it. Did I get that right, that you're saying that perhaps on the label, if it's using, say, like high fructose corn syrup that's from genetically engineered corn, that the corn syrup part might be identified within a label, but not necessarily brand the entire product as GMO?
So the law, the disclosure law, does give a lot of discretion to USDA to come up with implementing regulations in the law. And so the question, and USDA recently identified for the public 30 questions that it had that it is thinking about that will answer those questions in its regulations. And it asked the public for comment on those, or they could give their opinions on that. And so that comment period recently just ended a couple of weeks ago. So one of the questions arises, what do you do about a multi-ingredient product? So if we have a genetically engineered apple, it's pretty easy. You label the genetically engineered apple. Okay, maybe it's on the little sticker that goes on the apple that you buy, or maybe that sticker sends you to a website that talks about that particular apple. But you can make that information it's fairly easy. It either is genetically engineered or it's not genetically engineered. There's not a sort of ambiguity there. But what do you do when you have a multi-ingredient food? And we all purchase thousands of multi-ingredient processed foods all the time. What Vermont did in their law was required that the manufacturer identify on the package that either the words made with genetic engineering or partially made with genetic engineering. So if you had all the ingredients that came from genetic engineered crop or just some of the ingredients from the genetic engineered crop, that was the information that was provided. Other countries have had different things. So in Europe, for example, they have identified the particular ingredient that came from a genetically engineered crop. So they have an asterisk in the ingredient list, and that asterisk identifies itself as being genetically modified. And so they identify the specific ingredients within it. So there are different ways in different countries and different laws that would talk about how you would disclose or provide the information to the consumer. So that's one of the issues that USDA will have to determine is what do you do with a multi-ingredient food? And with a multi-ingredient food, we come into lots of different options. You know, is it one of the goals of our labeling system is to provide consumers with accurate information and information that is not misleading in any way. And so is it, you know, at what stage is it really accurate information to a consumer to call a product partially made with genetic engineering that has 40 or 50 ingredients and the consumer doesn't know which of those ingredients or how much of the food that they're eating actually came from a genetically engineered crop? So the example I've given is a frozen pizza where that product might need to be labeled partially produced with genetic engineering. It would have had to be labeled under Vermont's law that way. And yet, we don't have any genetically engineered wheat, so the dough is not genetically engineered. We don't have any genetically engineered cheese, so the cheese would not be genetically engineered, and we don't have any genetically engineered tomatoes. the tomato sauce would not be genetically engineered. And when you look at the ingredient list, you see that far down on that list, there may have been a little bit of corn oil or cornstarch or soybean oil or soy lecithin. Those may be very, very small ingredients in terms of by weight or volume of the total pizza. And the question is, if you call the whole pizza partially produced with genetic engineering, is that misleading in some way to a consumer? Because the consumer doesn't even think about those minor ingredients when they purchase that food. And will the label indirectly be telling the consumer that the consumer will wonder, well, is it the cheese or the tomatoes or the wheat that was genetically engineered, when the reality was it was one of these smaller ingredients?
The comments that USDA has received so far, are those public? Can people see what the comments have been, suggestions that have been made to USDA?
So I don't know if they are public yet. I would hope that the administration will make them public. I know that if somebody sent a Freedom of Information request, they would have to supply those comments to the individual who sent that request, so they are not confidential documents. There have been some organizations that have put them on their websites, so you could go to the Grocery Manufacturers Association's website and you could see their comments. And I know there have been a few press articles about it where they've linked to comments, like the Organic Trade Association has a comment that they put on their website. So some of the comments you may be from organizations you may be able to find on the web. Others from individuals you may only be able to get if USDA makes, when USDA makes them public. And I haven't checked yet to see if any of them, but I would guess is they have not made them public yet.
I'm glad you mentioned the Organic Trade Association, because that is one of the other things that's been determined, I understand, from the USDA's interpretation so far of the law, that organics, by definition, do not contain GMO. So products that are certified organic need not follow this law. Is that right? If they're, because they, again, they don't have genetic engineering by definition in organic products?
So any law, or when you implement a law, there's no such thing as zero or 100% of anything.
Okay.
And so the law identifies exemptions. And so there are exemptions from, for example, for food in restaurants or other kinds of food establishments don't have to label their, wouldn't have to disclose their food if their food came from a genetically engineered crop. Similarly, foods produced by very small food manufacturers, and again, that needs to be defined in the regulation, would not have to be. And even USDA has been told that they have to establish a threshold. So under a certain amount would not have to be labeled, and that could be 1% or 3%. It could be by weight. It could be by volume. It could be per ingredient. There's a host of ways that they could do it, but there, you know, I mean, sometimes we only can go to the level of detection, or we only can go so far in doing something. You know, nothing, it's hard to get anything that's 100% pure of one thing or another. So there's also a threshold that's to be set. One thing that the law also did set forth was that if you're an organic, certified organic farmer, you cannot use genetically engineered seeds. That those are an excluded method that are not allowed under the rules. And so there's a provision in the bioengineered food labeling, food disclosure law that was enacted in July of 2016 that says that if you are certified organic, then your food will not have to be labeled under this law or disclosed under this law. So what that means is that even if you had some inadvertent GM materials get into your food product by accident, and they went above the threshold that might be established, certified organic product would not have to disclose that information. Does that make any sense?
Sure. No, it does.
This is not what happened this summer when USDA provided 30 questions to the public and asked for answers. That was an informal comment period. It was put on their website. People could send in their responses. The agency will look at those responses. This is not the only bite at the apple that the public gets to help influence this, the implementation of this law. after the USDA has gone through these informal comments, they are required to publish a proposed rulemaking. And they've stated publicly, and I've read this in a number of different press articles, that they plan to release that proposed rulemaking sometime later this year, so sometime in 2017. There would be an official comment period that would be allowed under that proposed rulemaking under the Administrative Procedure Act. Whether that would be at least 30, would be at least 30 days, but it could be longer than 30 days for the public to provide comments. And then after those comments are all received, USDA will publish a final rule. So I don't want to give the impression that this was just an initial sort of informal comment period to help inform, to help give information to the regulator, who will now be publishing a more formal proposed rulemaking in the coming months.
And I believe the USDA is conducting studies, doing some research, trying to identify what obstacles are using different technology and that sort of thing. For example, you talked about QR codes. If a QR code took people to a site that had the information on whether genetic engineered and possibly other information as well, so the USDA is trying to determine how many people maybe have smartphones.
So one of the provisions that's in the law said that USDA was to conduct a study or hire a consultant or a contractor to do a study in the first year after the law was enacted to survey and determine access to electronic information that would be available to different consumers throughout the country. And so that might encompass things like how many people have cell phones or smartphones, mm-hmm. Whether there's internet service in supermarkets, whether there would be pieces of equipment that would be able to read QR codes for consumers in the supermarket, so they, if they didn't have a smartphone, they'd be able to collect the information. I'm not very familiar with the. USDA did do a request for a proposal for different contractors, and I did not read that document, so I don't know all the particular information that contractor was supposed to collect and analyze. But that report needed to be submitted to the agency by the end of July 2017. My understanding is that report has been submitted to the agency, but they have not released it yet to the public until they've done their review of that report. And that will also form a part of the public rulemaking process.
So when it's all said and done, sometime in the summer of 2018, the new rules will go into effect?
What the statute says is that USDA is required to promulgate the new rules that would implement the law no later than 2 years after the law was enacted, which in this case would be July 28th or 29th, 2018. Now, in the past, agencies often make those deadlines, but they don't always make those deadlines. So I'm not going to commit here on the broadcast that they are or will not make that deadline. They are supposed to meet that statutory deadline, is what I can say. I also can say from past experience that although a final rule will be promulgated in and around that time, that doesn't mean that the rule will automatically start being implemented the day that it's promulgated. So usually any kind of labeling laws or disclosure laws or laws that to the food industry require some period of time for them to adapt and to actually comply with the law. So if the law said, you need this information, you could put this kind of symbol on your package. Well, the food that's in our store can't all of a sudden overnight get that symbol on the package. It might take 6 months, 12 months, 18 months, or whatever before the new labels are printed that have that particular symbol on them and then are distributed to the supermarkets where we purchase our food. So even with the Vermont law, I believe they had a year or more period of time which they gave the industry to actually comply with the law before it sort of went into effect. So I think it's safe to say that there will be a period of time from when the final rule is promulgated to when food manufacturers will be required to do the disclosure.
You know, Greg, I understand what you're explaining. It's just such a long process. I'm sure that the people that thought that it could simply just say whether something contained GMO or not and be on the label for those that cared, I'm sure they're frustrated because this ends up taking years. And I understand the timetable as you've explained it, and it seems logical. But in the meantime, I suppose, too, that there's companies that are just going to go ahead and do something, whether it's the law or not. I mean, that there will be companies say, you know, my customers do or don't care, so I may make a decision that I'm just going to voluntarily put information out there and not wait for the federal law to go into effect. Because there's no law against providing more information than is required. Wouldn't that be true?
Right, that's correct. And some companies like Campbell Soup have said that they will voluntarily put on their labels whether the product contains ingredients or foods or ingredients that came from genetically engineered crops. And they've been doing that, but I would, again, caution the consumer, just because it says partially made with genetic engineering, what does that really tell you about the food? And if you buy a can of chicken noodle soup or tomato basil soup on either end, then there are other places. If you go in the supermarket now, there are some companies that have the labels that they produced for Vermont that are still being distributed all around the country. So when I went into my supermarket in McLean, Virginia, I was able to find a number of products that did have the language that Vermont required on the label. So there are some products that are labeled in the marketplace currently. I would also say that some of the companies who are advocating for the smart label, you can go on the webs on the internet, and I've done this to smart label. You can do a search for smart label, and then you will see that there are thousands of products where they have smart label information, including whether their product contains ingredients that came from a genetically engineered crop. So there are there's information out there, as well as other food manufacturers may have different information on their own websites about different products and whether they use ingredients that came from genetically engineered crops. So I wouldn't say there's no information out there that a consumer who wants to know can't find information. There is already a lot of information out there for the consumer who wants to who feels this is an important piece of information when they purchase food, that they can begin to collect that information.
Well, and as you said earlier, if people are concerned, they do have the choice of organic, too.
I would say that last year, the National Academy of Sciences put together a panel, and they did an exhaustive search of all the evidence that was out there about genetically engineered crops to date that are being grown, and their conclusion was that there was no evidence of any safety issue or any nutritional issue from any foods or ingredients made from those crops. So I think that there is a growing international consensus out there that foods and ingredients made from the currently grown crops are safe to eat, and consumers should not feel concerned about that.
Greg, the thing I sense is that there's more attention to possible overuse in some cases, not necessarily about genetic engineering per se, but there's many people that have been concerned about glyphosate, which is an active ingredient in Roundup, and bringing concerns up of the safety of glyphosate and overuse and issues that you've been involved before with GRIF. So it seems like rather than the basic technology, more energy is shifting towards specific areas of concern.
Well, that's why I like to talk about genetically engineered crops. So you can't generalize about them. You really got to look at them on a case by case basis. So, you know, there are lots of people out there who say, genetically engineered crops increase pesticide use. Well, that's a very broad statement. The reality is it depends on which crop you're talking about. If you're looking at cotton that's been engineered with a gene from Bacillus thuringiensis to produce a biological insecticide, the amount of chemical insecticides has really decreased in the cotton industry. And that's had some benefits to the environment and to farmers and so forth. On the other hand, if you're looking at crops that have been engineered to be tolerant to the herbicide glyphosate, which allows farmers to spray glyphosate over the top of the crop after the crop has emerged from the ground and not kill the crop but kill the weeds around it, we've seen an increased use in glyphosate, and we've also seen an increase in glyphosate-resistant weeds, as you mentioned. Which now requires farmers to use a second herbicide to kill the weed that it can't kill with glyphosate. So So I think you have to look at these, and that's why I said very early on that there have been some impacts, clearly, of these genetic engineered crops. But again, you've got to look at these things on a case-by-case basis.
A lot of opinions out there. I really appreciate your clarifying points, and I needed some updating myself, as you could tell from my questions, and you've kind of helped us walk through a really complicated kind of picture, I think, to consumers that wonder, wait a minute, what's happened with this whole issue? Where's the best source of information for consumers to follow what's going on?
For implementation of the disclosure law, the best place to look is obviously the USDA's website. And if anybody, if you just put in USDA and put in GMO disclosure, you'll come to the web page that USDA is updating. What is the status of their rulemaking process? And when they propose a rule, it'll be announced there. It'll tell people how to comment. It'll tell people probably how to review people's comments and see what else is being done in this area. So that would probably be the place to go if they're most interested in learning about how the federal government is implementing the law that was passed. That's the place to look.
And then if they want more information on from your site or CSPI in general, you have a website, no doubt.
Right. So if they, we have information like frequently asked questions and the submissions that we've done to federal regulatory agencies on different issues. And if they want to look at that, they would go to www.cspinet.org. And then there's a choice as you choose the Protecting Health. And then under the Protecting Health menu, you'll choose biotechnology. And that would take you to the different information that we have out there. I might also mention that one other place that consumers could go or people could go is the National Academy of Sciences has done a number of different excellent studies recently about genetically engineered crops and sort of, you know, looking at all the evidence that's out there to date on both safety from a food point of view, but also environmental safety, impacts, and so forth. And they did a report called Genetically Engineered Crops, Experiences and Prospects. And if somebody just puts in their Google search, you know, NAS GE crops, they will come up with the site that has this study, and it's extensive, but there's a summary paragraph, and that would be another place to look if somebody really wants to go into details in this area.
Thanks for listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.